From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we have a wide-ranging conversation with Professor Tony Montero about the international economic and political situation. We spoke with Professor Montero via Skype from Philadelphia on Thursday. Okay, Tony, well, gee whiz, what a week. We've got Brennan had his security clearance yanked. Turkey's currency is in play. They're talking about making a deal to make the Turkish lira convertible in rubles and the Chinese international currency, the renminbi. Mm-hmm. You've got a whole bunch of other things. Markets are tilting one way or another. It's a lot of moving parts and a lot of things that have been propping each other up with all kinds of tension at the base. It's just like something waiting for one little event to set off a chain.
Yeah, that's very true. I agree with that. And, you know, I've been, since the start of this crisis of the Turkish lira, I've been looking very closely at some of the indicators in financial markets and even what this crisis in the lira represents. And by the way, it was not set off, the crisis that is, by Trump imposing these sanctions.
Right.
That was just kind of icing on the cake. The real issue began after the Turkish elections, where they reelected Erdogan, and the European Central Bank went after Turkey and attacked its currency.
Right.
So this started in June, just like the European Central Bank went after the Italian economy and financial institutions after the populist won. This right. is a strategy of attacking governments that are not popular with the main financial oligarchs of the West, and attempting to force upon them policies which would make the governments unpopular, such as raising interest rates, which is a way of punishing the poor and the working class. So Turkey didn't go along with it. The European Central Bank attacked them, attacked its currency. The Turkish government has responded, I think, in a very responsible way, and it seems that Turkey is on its way to aligning its currency and its economy and its financial institutions with the East rather than with Europe.
Yeah, you know, Turkey's been sort of, you know, the redheaded stepchild of Europe with respect to the EU for many years now. We'd like to join the EU. Okay, stand on one foot and put your opposite hand on your nose. Okay, now can we join the EU? No. Well, now while you're doing that, spin slowly and sing Yankee Doodle Dandy backwards. Okay, now I'm doing whoosh, whoosh. Okay, now can we join? No. While you're doing that, in French, while you're still doing Yankee Doodle Dandy backwards, recite the creed of the French foreign leagues. In other words, they were putting them through hoops for years, and finally, in the last few years, you know, Turks were like, well, they're not going to let us in. That's just the way that is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if they were allowed into the EU, of course, that means the currency would be the euro.
Right.
The real issue is how much policy would be made for Turkey's economy in Turkey or in Brussels really Berlin, where a lot of that
Well, you know, I think the Turks and other players in the world economy realize that when we're months away from what could be the most devastating financial collapse in the history of world capitalism. Mm. The reason I say that, and you know, it's always when you say something like that, you have to be cautious because, you know, you can always predict the worst thing, the worst outcomes.
Right.
And then if they don't happen, people say, well, you know, that's all you do is predict the end of capitalism and it right. never happens and right. so on and so forth. But the reason I think we're on the cusp of something like that is by what's going on within the major capitalist countries themselves, not so much external to the Euro-American financial system, but what's going on internally. And there's certain things we have to look at. Number one, and this is reported in the Financial Times today, this growing hyper-concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands, and the fact that the share of the wealth produced, especially in the United States, but not exclusive to the United States, the share of that wealth going to working people is declining dramatically and wow. maybe at historic lows, yep. and the part of the wealth going to the 0.1% who control the major financial institutions of the Western world is larger now than ever.
That's right.
Now, that is always an indicator of something devastating happening going forward. Whenever you have
That's right.
this level of concentration of wealth,
right.
and you know, the remedy of the Obama administration and of the Western central banks after the 2008 collapse was not to break up these mega banks, but in fact to infuse money into them through quantitative easing, making them more powerful
right.
than they were before the collapse.
Yeah, that's what happened. All the wealth got transferred. The problem was that the banks had all the money, so the solution to that, as they collapsed, was give them more money. And so,
that's right.
And what you mentioned the fact that the U.S. Population is suffering this more intensively, and
yeah.
the irony, and also reinforcing your point, is the fact that that very same U.S. populace, that market, has been the market that drives not just national but global growth. Americans,
right.
by being the wealthiest consumers in the world, bought more stuff than anybody else, and that meant that more people got to sell stuff because Americans had money. And now that that money's gone, nobody has customers.
Well, the other thing is that the
China.
American consumers had access to credit.
And, yeah, that's all gone.
Yeah, which meant that we are the most indebted society
yeah.
maybe in history.
Yeah.
And this level of debt, and we're not talking about the government debt, which is now moving close to $22 trillion, but we're talking about mortgage debt, student debt, consumer debt. I mean, you put all this together, we're talking about an indebtedness that is about at least three times the gross domestic product of the nation. That is 300% larger than the gross domestic product. That's a sign of an economy that is teetering on the edge of collapse.
Yeah.
It is because what happens is that at some point, large numbers of people default and are unable to pay that debt.
Right.
Now, what happens to the banks that own that debt? Well, they withdraw and put their monies in hedge funds
and
in derivatives
market.
And offshore,
right.
which means then that the economy, which runs on credit and debt, comes to a standstill.
Right.
And as you point out, it affects the world economy as well.
Right.
I think the decisions being made by the Turkish government are decisions not just based upon what the ECB and the Trump administration have imposed upon them, but the fact that they see, I think what I am seeing and what you see, that things look bleak going forward, and we might be, and I think the chances are very high, that we might be looking at a major financial collapse within the coming year, which will not just bring down a major bank or a bank here and there, but could end the world dominance of the dollar as the reserve currency of all nations. And hence, that weapon will be taken away from the United States and its Western allies, used to punish nations for political and economic decisions that they might make in the interests of their own countries. Yeah. I think that, of course, everything is focused upon the coup d'etat against Trump. But there are other variables, other factors playing in to both the domestic politics and the global economy and global politics.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you mentioned the coup d'etat against Trump. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned the assault on Turkey's economy by both the ECB, the European Central mm-hmm. Bank, and the Trump administration, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is interesting because, of course, there have also been some serious contradictions there.
Right.
And, you know, you mentioned that, for example, the ECB has been a weapon against any populist governments, and mm-hmm. you point to mm-hmm. Turkey and Italy as two examples. Mm-hmm. And Trump has also been, you know, talking about meddling, the entire EU leadership and the UK, in Brexited or not, they all endorsed Hillary Clinton shamelessly.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. there's been major hostility to Trump pretty much since January 20th, 2017, although some of that, at least the rhetoric, has been toned down some since his trip to mm-hmm. Europe, you know, over the summer. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of nested contradictions. For example, mm-hmm. Greece went through its own crisis, and this was included the election of Syriza, which at the time looked like an outside radical left party that was not part of the Communist Party establishment or the mm-hmm. Socialist Party establishment, but rather people that weren't going to go in and be Euro-communists, but actual communists. And they were going to mm-hmm. pull out, and they were going to protect the sovereign and all that. And they've turned, of course, into accommodationists, as we've seen. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Turkey and Greece have been enemies, if not rivals, historically for a long time, even inside NATO. Mm-hmm. Greece, a member of the EU that has been poor relative, to say the least, and then, of course, Turkey aspiring and being dissed by the EU, mm-hmm. Greece being squashed with the euro, mm-hmm. Turkey being excluded from the euro, and the two of them still sort of facing off against each other inside this larger battle that's going on in Europe. It's mm-hmm. And then you have Turkey has been looking back and forth to Russia at least since the attempted coup against Erdogan. Right. And you'll recall, just prior to that, Turkey mm-hmm. shot down a Russian plane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Syria. So you've got a whole lot of moving parts that mm-hmm. could collide. You know, I'm not sure if it's a billiards table or not, the way they're moving at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, but see, the difference between now and 2008, or even before that, is that we see a growing set of alternatives for nations like Turkey. You know, they were suing to be a part of the European Union and were consistently denied that. And so they decide to give up on that. And now they're moving full speed ahead towards Russia, Iran, Syria, and China.
Right, the Belt and Road. Yep.
Yeah, one belt, one road. But then, you know, they were denying Turkey a right to be in the European Union all these years, and suddenly, in 2016, the Brits vote to leave it.
That's right.
And the question is, where does that leave the European Union? But also, where does that leave NATO? And I think that what we're looking at is the configuring of a new world order. I mean, to take a phrase from a reactionary, yeah. But it's something new coming into existence. From a rational, if you look at the rational kernel of Trump's policies of withdrawing from these trade and multi-state alliances like the Trans-Pacific Partnership or NAFTA, which are designed to uphold and further empower finance capital. What he's saying is that those alliances impoverish the American working class, right, and middle classes,
right,
and to give them a life, you would have to go the opposite direction towards reindustrialization rather than deindustrialization. Right. Now that's the rational kernel. I don't know that he and his people know how to get there. Right. I don't think you can do it within the framework of the existing set of social and economic relations in the United States, something completely new, including a redistribution of wealth from the top to the people. But these are complicated questions in a very complicated moment in history.
Yeah.
But I would suggest that the left and the progressive, the genuinely progressive forces, must begin to think of how we navigate this transition and not be looking at a group of 10 or 12 so-called alt-right or white supremacists marching to the White House and this response of 10,000 to these 10 or 12 people and see that as somehow a fight for democracy. That is not where the fight has to be directed.
Right.
The fight has to be directed at one, policies that if this financial system collapses again, if it collapses again, then what are the solutions? And do we allow the government and the Federal Reserve and Treasury to decide who the winners and losers are coming out of such a collapse, as was the case in the 2008-2009 thing? I just think the left has to focus upon where the real problem, the real crisis is. And as you point out, it's on two levels. It's at the level of the global financial system. And, you know, as I tried to say, there are many indicators of the way things are going, that these are manifestations of crisis. I think I mentioned $1,000 trillion dollars in derivatives.
Right.
That are managed by banks and hedge funds and sovereign funds of nations. I mean, what is this? You know, I mean, just to get your head around.
Right. $1,000 trillion, first of all, is a quadrillion.
A quadrillion.
And
a
derivative, for folks that don't know, is let's do this. Here's a thing. And it has an intrinsic value of $1,000, okay? Whatever it is, this McGill right here. It's worth $1,000. But what I do is I sell off, say, shares of $100 value in it that end up aggregating $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this guy owns $1,000 worth of this $1,000 asset. He turns around and sells shares in his ownership for, say, 10 times their individual value. The secondary instrument is a derivative. It's derived from the ownership of the first. You have a quadrillion dollars worth of value that rests on whatever the aggregate value of everything that's secured at the bottom is, but they're out of scale one to the other. And so if you kick the foot of the two legs that are holding this whole thing up, not just the thing itself falls, but a superstructure that's many times the size of the thing itself falls on top of it.
Yeah. And this is really the final outcome of the financialization of world economic relationships.
Yep.
It is kind of the final manifestation of the control of finance capital and of these super oligarchs a very tiny part of the human population, which controls all of the most powerful levers of economic and financial relationships now. But they have gone beyond anything reasonable. And as you mentioned, these derivatives. And then, of course, the bundling of stocks and bonds, and then selling them as though they right. represented what the sellers say they do.
Right.
But it's...
Right.
It's a complete fiction.
In my example, I said that the underlying thing was worth $1,000. But it's more like... The guy who owns it claims it's worth $1,000.
That's right. That's right.
And maybe it's only worth $50.
Absolutely. And you know, and especially when you get dollar-denominated
right.
Stocks or bonds. See, the
where you can manipulate the value. Where you can manipulate the actual value. Right.
And that is what we call the special privileges that the dollar
right.
has.
That's
because
right.
it is the reserve currency,
right?
And has been, and still to this day, 2/3 of global trade is done in dollars.
Right.
Most currencies are denominated in terms of dollars.
Right.
If a nation like Turkey borrows money from, let us say, a German bank, more than not, that debt is denominated in dollars, and that is why they're always measuring the value of the Turkish lira in terms of the dollar. Now, if it goes down, that may be stable in terms of the German mark, but if it goes down in terms of the dollar, which the debt is denominated in, that
right.
means that the Turkish people will pay more liras for
right.
the debt that they have with a German bank.
Yep.
I mean, this is a vicious circle. But it is a casino
right.
where fewer and fewer people are making any decisions. And I think all of this, and this is why I say, when you look at this situation, it is unsustainable, first of all. But the question for us should be, when will the collapse come? It will come, but how soon? And what will be the response of the left and progressive forces
yeah.
to it?
Yeah, you're looking at this whole picture, for example. When you talk about, say, the dollar being a reserve currency of the world and having all of the power over the economies of the world that goes with that, you're mm-hmm. really talking about not the United States of America per se, not even the government of the United States of America per se, or not even mm-hmm. really the governors or the various officials of the central bank, but rather the powerful economic interests that
yeah.
own all of that. There are some
That's
real
fine.
People in whom that power rests. And as you have these structural earthquakes,
mm-hmm.
Where suddenly control of the apparatus starts to slide, for example, because of the political condition and maybe even to a degree, maybe a large degree, the random effect of having Trump accidentally become president and whatever
mm-hmm.
impact that's having, but
right.
the trend generally where China's renminbi is becoming a global currency and where they're
right.
looking at creating baskets of currencies that would compete
right.
with the dollar,
right.
those
yeah.
economic interests behind the dollar aren't necessarily stapled to it. So
mm-hmm.
perhaps their response to the dollar being, you know, losing that status is going to be to assume control of the ascendant ones. And, you know, these are people that play hedge games for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they sell a little bit of dollar today so that the renminbi is stronger tomorrow and then back and forth, and they got derivatives,
mm-hmm.
futures, and everything else on all of that. In other words,
mm-hmm.
just because we kick this particular structure in the shins and it starts to collapse doesn't mean it weakens their control of the game, and perhaps
mm-hmm.
it actually strengthens it, because we don't
yeah.
know what the hell's going on behind the curtain. How do we engage under those conditions?
Well, I can tell you one thing. You talk about hedging. The Chinese and Russian governments are hedging by buying gold.
Yeah.
And so if, let us say, the dollar goes into crisis, not just a financial house on Wall Street, but the dollar goes into crisis, which means that more and more nations, be they Saudi Arabia or Venezuela or China or Russia, decide that they will trade in other currencies, which means they get rid of their dollars, which also, which the Russians have already begun doing. They get rid of their dollars, which means that the value of the dollar plummets. But that means at the same time that people that have any sense, even the financial oligarchs, will turn to a currency which is based on something more than the say-so of the people in power in a particular country.
Right.
And therefore, gold becomes a very important underpinning
right.
of a currency which will be considered reliable.
Right.
I think the other thing is that the petro-yuan, whereby Saudi Arabia and China will trade in oil
right.
With this petro-yuan. This is another blow to the dollar
yep.
and the petrodollar. And perhaps as Venezuela looks for ways to come out under these sanctions and the crisis, the political and economic crisis that they're in, they might begin to deal selling their oil in petro-yuan.
And also Iran is exploring the same
absolutely,
thing.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. So you, I mean, we see the variables at play here. And as you point out, this is not separated from political events, i.e. the election of Donald Trump, which throws the future of political control out of whack in the United States, or the Italian election, or Brexit, or the crisis, the political crisis in Germany.
Right.
These political events affect the markets. That's a big joke. The
yeah.
markets,
yep.
in other words, the financial markets, because it throws political uncertainty into the game,
right.
which is already unstable and uncertain from a financial point of view.
We got about 2 minutes left, and in that time, maybe you can address this. Let's say, looking all the way at the bottom, even gold. Everything in the world has been destroyed except for you and I, and a house full of a lifetime of supply of food, electricity, and comfort, and
yeah.
a massive pile of gold. I've got the gold. You've got the house full of everything you need to survive. I want to buy the house. You selling, even if it's gold?
Well, I would sell it if it's gold. The gold is a investment in a future where everything in the present moment is uncertain and unstable. You have to see some concept of a future. And the future is that which we fight for.
Gotcha.
We progressives fight for a future. Now, in fighting for that future, we must account for all of the variables in the now time. There are two trends in the world economy. There's the trend towards stable industrial production, where trade is done in reliable currencies, and there is the other trend of the dollar, which is an unreliable currency, and the Federal Reserve and European Central Bank, which use the dollar as weapons politically and economically against nations and governments that do not submit to the wishes of the Western oligarchs. I think those two trends are now crystallizing on the world scene. I think that while it's not certain what the immediate outcome will be, I would bet in the long term on the renminbi and those currencies that are grounded in something more than the say-so of a government or the central banks of particular nations.
Tony, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.